parsha of Shoftim, of course, full of mitzvahs, and the mitzvahs deal with really the leadership. We have the Shoftim, we have the Melech, we have the Navi, and others. And as the Sephorno, in his classic brief style, explains the progression, really, of Chumash Devarim, of the contents, whereby last week's parsha, Parshas Re'eh, where, as always, the weekly Torah portion does not take a summer vacation, so that was very much happening in Shul. And Parshas Re'eh deals with matters that relate to the Jewish people in general. The halachas, reviewing the halachas of kashrus, and when it has to bring korbanos, and so many other things. And from the discussion of the klal of the Jewish people, we then move on to the discussion of leadership, of the manhigim, because the success of the klal is very much impacted by the status, stature, and caliber of their leaders. In the words of the Sforno, shebekilkulam, or actually firstly, shebetikunam, yitukan inyan haklal. If the leaders are on level, or as they should be, then the klal will also be in good shape. Uvikilkulam yikulkal. If there's a corruption or much to be desired in the leadership, that will also have its effects and reverberations on the community as a whole. And therefore we go from talking about the Jewish people as a people to those that really are responsible. And we see from here, the Sforno and others does not shy from expressing not only the prestige that comes with the station of leadership, but also the tremendous responsibility and accountability of the leaders in terms of being as they should be. So Shoftim v'Shotrim, the mitzvah to set up the Sanhedrin, and there's a number of attendant mitzvos that relate to this. They should not favor people, and they should not take a bribe. And then, in Pasuk Kaf Aleph, I mean, the opening sukkim are, in our way of referring to it, the final sukkim of Perek Tet Zayin. In Pasuk Kaf Aleph of Perek Tet Zayin, we have the following mitzvah: Lo sita lecha asherah kol eitz. You shall not plant an asherah, or any tree. Now, what is an asherah? An asherah is a tree that's associated with avodah zarah, whether the tree itself is worshipped or whether avodah zarah is worshipped under the tree, but it's very much associated with avodah zarah. That's an asherah tree. You can't plant one of those, or any tree for that matter, etzel mizbach Hashem Elokecha asher ta'aselach, next to the mizbeach. There cannot be any trees planted near the Mizbeach. And this is a very interesting mitzvah for a number of reasons. Firstly, in terms of itself. After all, we're entitled to ask, why not? I mean, leaving aside the Asherah, presumably you shouldn't plant an Asherah anywhere. But to have a tree next to the Mizbeach, one would not have intuitively imagined that that is a something that is objectionable, and yet clearly it is. But why? What's wrong with the tree next to the Mizbeach? I could think of worse things to put next to the Mizbeach than a tree. And moreover, internally within this mitzvah, given that the Torah will immediately go on to expand the prohibition to all trees, kol eitz, why then does it mention specifically the Asherah first? It could have just said, lo sita lecha kol eitz, but it mentions the Asherah as the its own category almost, and then expands it to the entire spectrum of trees. Moreover, in addition to pondering what is the meaning of this mitzvah, as we know, we always need to keep an eye on not only content, but also location. What is this mitzvah doing in the middle of a section that is dedicated to the mitzvahs of Shoftim v'Shotrim? I mean, this is a mitzvah, you could put it by the Korbanos or by the Beis HaMikdash, but we've only just launched the Parsha of Shoftim, and we interrupt, so to speak, to give another mitzvah of a different category altogether of what to put near the Mizbeach. And interestingly, this final point is picked up on by the Gemara. The Gemara in Maseches Sanhedrin and Daf Zayin Amud Aleph asks this very question. I mean, what's this got to do with Dayanim? And the Gemara gives a rather enigmatic answer, which itself will need to be understood. Lo malacha, it's to teach you, says the Gemara, kol hamamid dayon she'eno hogun. Anyone who appoints a dayan, a judge, who is not qualified or is not good, does not deserve to be a judge, ki ilu nata ashera etzel hamizbeach. It's as if he planted an ashera tree by the mizbeach. So if you want to know what this mitzvah of not putting a tree next to the mizbeach has to do with shoftim, because if you appoint the wrong type of judge, it's the equivalent, it's tantamount to having planted an asherah tree next to the mizbeach. Well, formally, that has answered the question. But needless to say, it only leads to further questions. As if to say, why are you like someone who's put an asherah next to the mizbeach? Seemingly, the two things are not yet connected in any way that we can perceive. And this question is discussed, all of these questions are discussed at length, quite some length, by the Meshech Chochma. And he begins by really discussing the question of korbanos themselves. There's many different angles from which to approach korbanos. What are they about and what do they do? And in all of their categories and all of their procedures. But Meshech Chochma raises the most basic question, and that is, who are they for? I mean, who benefits from korbanos? And the reason why this is important is because the Jewish people, lahavdil, are not the only people that have a concept of korbanos. But they are the only people that have a Jewish concept of korbanos. But what does that mean? We're mindful of the well-known statement of Rambam, that the idea of korbanos is very much apropos of the fact that other religions have korbanos, and the Torah says you've got to do it the right way and not the wrong way. But at the core of doing korbanos the right way is understanding who they benefit, because any other religion, to refer to them in that way, their notion of what a korban does is that it empowers the deity. They literally serve in the sense of giving strength to the deity. This is especially so in that they see their deities are in competition with other deities. And that's part of the polytheism versus monotheism. It's not just a question of the many versus the one. As soon as there's many, so then there is no all-powerful deity, which means that they need to be empowered vis-a-vis the others. And hence, enter the servant, and he will then empower this deity, and hopefully, if he scratches the deity's back, it will scratch his, and they'll have an understanding relationship. And of course, all of that is the opposite of Torah, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is all-powerful, which means he's not in competition with anyone. He is behind all forces, so he doesn't need to be empowered. So the entire benefit flow of a korban is actually reversed, whereby the beneficiaries of the korbanos are people and the world. They're people because the experience of bringing a korban can be an elevating experience, as different mefarshim discuss in different ways. If a person has perhaps done something wrong and he sees and is required to bring a korban, and what happens to the korban should be happening to him, it can lead him to take stock of the way his life is leading. He emerges with a better direction. And moreover, although this is in a more mystical plane, a more cosmic plane, but the way the Mikubalim describe the korbanos is that they serve to align all levels of creation, allowing for the flow of divine energy into the world, what's called Kishur Ha'olamos Zebazeh. Who benefits from all of that? Us, at the bottom of the food chain, whereby all of that energy comes in. That is the polar opposite, the diametric contrast to the other way of looking at korbanos. And in fact, the Meshech Chochma quotes a very interesting statement, somewhat cryptic, of Ben Azai. We're familiar with Ben Azai from the Mishnah, and in the very end of Maseches Menachos and Daf Kuf Yud, Ben Azai draws our attention to the name of Hashem. We know that Hashem has many names, But there's only one name that is ever referred to with vis-a-vis korbanos, and that's the name of Yudke Vavke, right? What's called the Shem Havaya, Yudke Vavke. Bo Re'ei, come and see, says Ben Azai. And even that, says Meshech Chochma, Bo Re'ei, we might take that as perhaps some form of a lyrical introduction, but Bo Re'ei means something is very significant is about to be said. Pay close attention. It's a major principle that's about to be discussed. Bo Re'ei, Shelo Ne'emar B'Korbanos. We never find, as a rule, with reference to Korbanos, Lo Kael, we don't find the name Kael, Aleph Lamed, or Elokim. Pasuk never says to bring a korban l'Elokim. Only ever Shem Havaya, Shem Hashem. Shelo Niten Pischon Peh L'Minim. In order not to give an opening to heretics, or however you define what minim are, there could be more than one definition, but the common denominator is people that get it wrong. And what's the mistake they could make, and how is that mistake apprehended by, or anticipated, by using only the name of Yudke Vavke? Says Meshech Chochma, the names Kael and Elokim have a connotation of force. Ael, Aleph Lamed, means something that is strong. It's even a word in Lashon HaKodesh, even not referring to Hashem. Lahavdil, Ben Kodesh Lachol. Eile Haaretz, those the strong of the land. Elohim is a judge, someone who's powerful. Malachim are also called Elohim. And it's important to use that in pronouncing that word with a hey. Because we only say Elokim as an expression of respect when you're talking about HaKadosh Baruch Hu as Elokim. But the very same word can be used with regards to people and angels. And there it is not correct to say Elokim, because that means you're deifying a person. Sometimes people, they have this instinctive reaction. They see the word and they put a kuf in there and they think they're giving respect to the word. It's actually a very serious mistake. But in any case, How does HaKadosh Baruch Hu share this name with other people? Because these are individuals or beings of power, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is the ultimate power. But because those names, Kael and Elokim, refer to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as a force of strength, they can never be used with reference to Korbanos. Because then the misconception may set in that a person is bringing a korban in order to strengthen, in order to empower HaKadosh Baruch Hu, as others say, lahavdil, about their deities. And that's what Ben Azai says by directing our attention to the fact that the only name that is ever used in the Torah with reference to korbanos is the Shem Havaya, the name of Yudke Vavke, because that's the name which disavows such a misconception. Because Yudke Vavke is HaKadosh Baruch Hu behind all of existence. He is the force behind all forces. And therefore, he gives all strength to everything, does not need to receive strength. That is why the korbanos only ever associated with the name of Yudke Vavke. What does this have to do with trees? Says Meshech Chochma, we note that the Torah is very insistent that the Mizbeach, where the korbanos takes place, be made up of stones. Mizbeach Avonim, Taseli, Avonim Shleimos. Why is it so important that the Mizbeach be made of stones? Because a stone, in its interaction with other things, doesn't grow from them, or it isn't made stronger by them. It is what it is. It's there as itself, but the result of the transaction may help other things, but the stone is never a stronger stone at the end. That's in contrast with a tree, because a tree, if it interacts with other things, it can be affected by them, for better or for worse. And now we can begin to get an insight, a deeper understanding as to what is behind the prohibition in the Torah to plant a tree anywhere near the Mizbeach. The Mizbeach where Korbanos takes place, it's got to be stones and no trees. The Mizbeach represents HaKadosh Baruch Hu's role here, and things are offered to HaKadosh Baruch Hu on the Mizbeach. It's got to be something that is not strengthened, not empowered, not developed through the process of korbanos, as HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself is not, because the benefit is for us. You put a tree there, and the implication is of korbanos, so representing HaKadosh Baruch Hu's side, also grow from it like a tree grows. That's why the trees are distanced. And that is why, says Meshech Chochma, although immediately the Torah will broaden the scope of trees to all trees, but it begins by mentioning an Asherah, because the very name Asherah represents this concept. We're not quite sure how to translate Asherah, which means all good translations are transliterations. It's basically called an Asherah tree. But sometimes, you know, if it's possible for something to get lost in translation, it doesn't have a hope in transliteration. But what is the meaning of the word Asherah? Chazal discussed this in the Medrash, and Chazal say that this relates to the word le'asher. Le'asher means to confirm, to strengthen. Ve'ishru eschem, yasher kochecha. And therefore, Asherah represents, one could almost say, the entire non-Jewish approach to korbanos in a nutshell. The tree grows through the korbanos. It's an Asherah. It's misasher with an aleph. It's misasher. It's enhanced through the korbanos. And that's why the Torah says Asherah really is what represents everything that's wrong with putting a tree next to the mizbeach, because the mizbeach doesn't grow from the korbanos. We grow from the korbanos. And having discussed for a few moments what's behind the prohibition of putting a tree next to the mizbeach, we then return to the statement of the Gemara in Sanhedrin, which said that if someone appoints a dayan who's not worthy to be a dayan, it's like you put an Asherah tree next to the Mizbeach. What's one thing got to do with the other? How is one tantamount to the other? Says Meshech Chochma. The Torah has very high expectations of a judge. A person could be a judge for many reasons. He could become a judge for many reasons. Only one of them is acceptable. Namely, to represent HaKadosh Baruch Hu in dispensing judgment and bettering society. That is the only acceptable goal. There are other goals. A person could become a judge for the prestige. If there's money in it, whether in the form of a nice salary or perhaps benefits on the side, that could be another reason why a person would become a judge. None of those are acceptable. And therefore, the Torah says, the dayan, he's like a mizbeach. That's the point. That's what a mizbeach is doing here. He's got to be like stone. In other words, he gives benefit, but he doesn't grow, not in that unhealthy or unacceptable sense. And that is why in Parshas Devarim, Moshe says to the Dayanim, and he's appointed them, right, the Sarei Chamishim, Sarei Meos, and all of those, he says to them, you need to know, Hamishpat Lelokim Hu. Mishpat, we would translate that the Mishpat belongs to God, but he has told people to judge. Hamishpat Lelokim Hu means it's a godly endeavor, and therefore has to be undertaken for, so to speak, godly purposes. Namely, in the same way that HaKadosh Baruch Hu bestows good into the world, and that's the nature of his interaction. Hamishpat lelokim, mishpat is like that. It has to be a process of giving, and that needs to be the motivation of bringing blessing into the world and making society a better place, and not necessarily making the person's own situation better. If someone is not worthy to be a judge, so why is he a judge? He's presumably not doing a good job. That means he's a judge for all the wrong reasons. And if he's a judge for the wrong reasons, what's in it for him? That's an Asherah tree next to the Mizbeach. He's more tree than stone, and that's not acceptable. Indeed, says Meshech Chochma, there's a well-known statement, and as soon as you say it, there's a very famous question that accompanies it. The Gemara states, I think even Rashi quotes it in Parshas Yisro, it's Gemara also in Sanhedrin, Kol hadan din emes la'amito. Anyone who judges true judgment in truth, nase shutof la'kadosh baruch hu b'maisa bereishis. He's like a partner with Hashem in creation. It's based on that pasuk in Parshas Yisro, because the pasuk says that Yisro saw Moshe and he was judging the people min haboker ad ha'erev. You see those two terms, boker and erev, and that has an association by erev by yivoker. I mean, that's the creation of the world. And the Gemara says yes, because if a person judges true judgment, in truth, he is a partner in the creation of the world. Kol hadan din emes la'amito. Of course, the question is, what's emes la'amito? They both seem to mean exactly the same thing. Emes is truth. La'amito is truth. So, but is there false truth? I mean, what's so why the double expression? Em islamito. But the truth is, says Meshe Chochma, em islamito reflect two different aspects of the judge. Number one, the correctness of the decision. Is he judging correctly? Is it a din emes? And number two, the correctness of his motivation, of his contribution. Where is his idealism? Emes lamito means that he's judging the right way for the right reasons. It's true judgment, but it's truth in the sense that it's genuine in its motivation and not perhaps for altruistic reasons, ulterior motives. And therefore, the Gemara says, it's possible for the judge to be like a partner to Hashem by judging, but he's got to judge in the way that Hashem created the world. Otherwise, he's not a partner in creation. Hashem created the world as a benefactor. And therefore, a person is only a partner to that if he judges also as a benefactor. True judgment for true reasons. And this then is the understanding of this seemingly unlikely mitzvah, or its location within the midst of the mitzvahs of Shoftim, to then be talking about the Mizbeach and the Asherah. And we see, aside from the Parshanut of the Meshech Chochma, we see the very high standards and expectations that the Torah has from its Dayanim, not only in terms of the correctness of what they do, but also the correctness of why they do it. So those are very profound comments, really, of Meshech Chochma there in the beginning. Now, one of the aspects, the well-known aspects, in fact, of Shoftim, is the institution of Eidos, of testimony. As we know, in order for many significant things to happen, you need to have two Eidim. One is not enough. And we find, for example, in Perek Yud Zayin, Pasuk Vav, which is still in Rishon, So this is dealing with capital cases on the basis of the testimony of two Eidim or three Eidim, and the Gemara discusses the obvious question: if two are enough, then three should certainly be enough. There's two in every three, at least. Lo yumas api eidecha, but not on the testimony of one witness. And there we have it, black on white, al pishnaim Eidim or shlosha Eidim, yumas hames. Now, what's interesting is, and the halacha is well known, of course, but what's interesting is that this very stipulation in a slightly different context is reiterated later on in the parsha. Let's take a look at Perek Yud Tes, Pasuk Tes Vav. Perek Yud Tes, Pasuk Tes Vav. The pasuk reads, Layokum Eidecha Be'ish. One witness that did not rise up to testify about someone, l'chol avon, l'chol chatos, b'chol chet, asher chata, for any matter of sin. We're not going to get into all of those particular categories. But as the pasuk concludes, apishne edim, apishlosha edim, yokum davar. A matter, and it relates generally to matters of money, and obligations, debts, and liabilities, etc. As we know, also money does not change hands, or cannot be extracted with less than two edim. So we have in Rishon, right, in Perek Yud Zayin, with regards to a capital case, and we had now in Perek Yud Tes with regards to monetary cases, and the halacha is the same in both of them. You need a minimum of two witnesses. But what's very interesting is, if we compare these two psukim, we note that they're not exactly the same, leaving aside the difference in context. But the stipulation of how these two edim are referred is slightly different, because if we go back to the earlier pasuk, Perek Yud Zayin pasuk Vav, it says al pi shnayim edim yokum davar. But in the later pasuk, Yud Tes Tes Vav, it says al pi shnei edim. Sorry, the first one is al pi shnayim edim yumas hames, and the second is al pi shnei edim. So the question, of course, the Lashon HaKodesh question is, what's the difference between shnayim edim and Shnei Edim. So perhaps the most helpful way to approach this question is to ask, if we may, which is the correct one, and therefore, that will then identify the one that needs to be explained. I think we'll all concur that the correct one is the second one, Shnei Edim. Because as a rule, Shnayim is never followed by the thing that it's two of, and that's really the difference between them. Shnayim is two. So how many Edim are there? Shnayim. But how do you say two Edim? You don't say Shnayim Edim. You say Shnei Edim. In the same way that we say Shnei Luchos HaBris, we don't say Shnayim Luchos HaBris, even though there were Shnayim. So when the word is the final word in this phrase, it's Shnayim. But when it's two of something, it's Shnei. Which means the second pasuk in Perek Yotes, that's the correct one, Shnei Edim, two Edim. The one which will need to be examined, therefore, is the earlier one, Shnayim Edim. Why do you take a non-construct, it's almost a disjunctive now, and put it that way, Shnayim Edim? This question is discussed by the Netziv in the Hamak Dover, and he actually refers our attention to a comment of Rabbeinu Bachya in Parshas Truma, which will then form the basis of his explanation here. Why would this be related to Parshas Truma at all, let alone Rabbeinu Bachya? Because we have a similar phenomenon in Parshas Truma. The first of the vessels, the appurtenances of the Mishkan to be mentioned is the Aron. The Aron, which is then covered in gold, inside and out. And then there's a kaporis, a lid on top. And what's on top of the kaporis? Two kruvim. Now what's interesting is, there in Shemos, Perek Kaf Hei, when it describes the kruvim, it says, ve'asisa shnayim kruvim. So once again, and that is the first time, as far as I know, that is the first time that we have this idea, where shnayim, which just shouldn't naturally lead into something else, but it does. It should be Shnei Kruvim. But they're called Shnayim Kruvim. And Rabbeinu Bachya explains. Although the norm should be Shnei Kruvim, and Shnei whatever. But with regards to the Kruvim, it says Shnayim. And the reason why is because the Ayim ending, that suffix, has a connotation not only of two, but of a pair. And what's interesting is, when one thinks about all the things that really work together, we'll call them that. We'll call them raglayim, and yadayim, and osnayim, and einayim. And there's a further very interesting point. And that is, says Rabbeinu Bachya, sometimes in order for, or typically perhaps even, in order for things to work well together, they can't be exactly the same. They need to complement each other. And that's how they work together. Otherwise, it's just more of the same thing. Interestingly, whether it's the hands and feet or eyes and ears, it's actually the difference between them that makes them better. It's the fact that the two eyes are not exactly in the same place. They see things slightly differently, which gives a depth of perspective. And because the two ears are not hearing exactly from the same vantage point, they give a person a sense of where the sound is coming from and balance, etc. and so forth. And so too, because the hands and the feet, they're opposite to each other, right, but not identical, on the contrary. So all of these allow them to work well together. That's why scissors are called misparayim. If the two blades were identical, you couldn't cut a thing. It's actually the difference between them that allows them to work, and the whole is more than the sum of the parts. And therefore, says Rabbeinu Bachya, the kruvim are called shnayim kruvim. Why? Because they were not identical. This is where we see the source, or the yisod within the pasuk, of what Chazal told us, that the two kruvim didn't look exactly the same, because they were a zug. They represent HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the Jewish people. Kimsos Choson Al Kala. One had the facial features of a male and one of a female. They're not the same. And that's what makes them a zug. And that's what makes them a partnership. Like spouses. And that's why the two kruvim are not shnei kruvim. Because it's the difference between them that actually brings them closer together. And that's called shnayim kruvim. A team in that way. Coming back to our parsha, says the Netziv something very interesting. There is a Yushalmi, and it's quoted by the Rosh with regards to testimony. And there is no more sensitive area of testimony than with regards to a capital case. Nothing could be reversed. And the Yushalmi says, of course, the testimony of the two witnesses, they need to check out as being the same. However, they should not be identical. Yerushalmi says, if two witnesses come before the Beis Din, the Sanhedrin, and they say exactly the same thing, continue to question them. Because sometimes the homogeny of the testimony itself could be grounds for suspicion. As if it almost sounds like they've memorized the same text. They're so identical that they actually are great suspicion. Rather, it is the desired testimony that is we're looking for is where they say effectively the same thing in every area that matches, but they don't say it in the same way, because then you know it's coming from each person, as opposed to perhaps one person schooling the other in what to say, or perhaps a third party schooling both of them. And that's a very interesting insight, of course, resonates very, very quickly. And that, says the Netziv, even though it's true generally, but as is often the case in Parshanut, and this is the Yesod that the Netziv discusses a lot, the place where the Torah will put it is where it's most critical. And there is no more critical area where we don't have room for error than in a capital case. And that's where the Torah says, they shouldn't be identical, the two Edim. They should be a team, but in the sense that they corroborate what each other is saying, but not repeat what each other is saying. And that's why, with regards to Edim, it says, Al pi shnayim Edim. The concept is true for money as well, but with regards to money, the Torah reverts to the norm, Shnei Edim. It's stated what it needs to state with regards to the capital case, and then apply it as appropriate. Interestingly, there is, I believe, a corroborating idea on this very question, which is to be found in the writings of Rabbi Yeshua Heller. Rabbi Yeshua Heller, we do not have much from him on the Chumash, but he has a famous drasha that relates to the Mishkan. And in the course of that drasha, he has occasion to discuss many other things. It is a very full treatment. The drasha itself is 60 pages long. It has 11 introductions. So as we can appreciate, there is room for pertinent digressions here and there. And one of the things he discusses, by the way, is the concept of Shnayim Kruvim, which is Rabbeinu Bachya's question. And Rabbi Yeshua Heller, and I believe it complements what Rabbeinu Bachya is saying, namely, he also discusses the difference between Shnayim something and Shnei something, and explains that Shnayim something refers to when the two are connected with each other. Shnei something means there are two of them, meaning more than one, less than three, doesn't mean that they're connected to each other, it just tells you how many of them there are. But Shnayim of something tells you that not only there's two, but they're connected. And I think it works very well with Rabbeinu Bachya, because as a Zug, they're connected. He brings a very interesting example of this from Sefer Yehoshua. It's the Haftarah for Parshas Shelach. So Shelach, of course, is the episode of the Meraglim, the 12 that Moshe sent. And the Haftarah, as we've discussed many times in Parshas Shelach, are the two Meraglim that Yeshua sent. And interestingly, the two Meraglim are described differently at different stages in that parak. The Haftarah begins, I believe it's Yeshua parak base. The Haftarah begins, Vayishlach Yehoshua Shnayim Anashim Meraglim. He sent Shnayim Anashim. Two men. So once again, we have a similar question. Why Shnayim Anashim? Shnei Anashim. Moreover, they're mentioned again a couple of times in the Perek, and there they're called Shnei Anashim. Why here Shnayim? The answer is very simple. They're a team, and they're helping each other, which means as they're dispatched as a unit, and as a team, each one with their own strengths, but very much working together. That's called Shnayim Anashim. The next time we see them referred to as two men is when Rachav hides them. Somehow, As much as they seemingly kept a low profile, very rapidly the king of Jericho found that they were in town, and he knew exactly where to go. Right, he went to Rahab's house, right, Rahab, Azona, and he says, "Where were they?" That they're very quick. Amazingly, they weren't discouraged. It's really, you see, it's a matter of perspective, as if to say the Meraglim. And this, my cousin, though, discussed it recently. We met at a simcha, Rabbi Ram Cooperman, one of Rabbi Yehuda Cooperman's sons. He said, it's amazing. You see how much is a question of attitude. Because if you look at the Meraglim in Parsha Shelach, everything they saw was cleared for them and it was outstanding, but they had a negative vision and they discussed everything negatively and brought back a negative report. Look at Yeshua's two Meraglim. They were running for their lives practically from the minute they got there. And they came back and they said, it's fantastic, let's go. So it's very much a question of how you interpret and what you make of what it is that you see. Now there it says that Rahab took et shnei ha'anoshim and she hid them. Why have they gone from shnei ha'anoshim to shnei ha'anoshim? The answer is in the next word in the pasuk. The word for and she hid them is vatitzpeno, safun, hid, vatitzpeno in the singular, because she hid each one in a different place. And therefore, they're no longer together. And that's why there's still two of them. But that's now Shnayim Anashim have become Shnei Anashim. And moreover, as she sends them back, and they're looking now to evade detection, they split up. And that's why the pasuk says, Vayoshuvu Shnei Anashim, also as Shnei. Because they don't come back together, right? Each one wants to attract as least attention as possible. It's sometimes, in situations like that, it's better to split up. Each one makes their own way back. And that's why they become Shnei Anashim. So it's amazing. It's chinuch in terms of how to learn Navi. I think one can hear the Haftarah of Shelach many times and perhaps not pick up on, is it Shnei Anashim? Is it Shnei Anashim? We need the Gedolim sometimes to make sure that we don't move on without noticing what needs to be noticed. But how does this relate to the Kruvim? Once again, says Rabbi Shua Heller, because the Kruvim, they're connected, and that's why it's Shnayim Kruvim. And here we may add, and it's still based on Rabbi Shua Heller, the two Kruvim are mentioned twice in the Torah, in two separate parshas. As we know, the Mishkan is repeated. It's said for the first time in Truma, and then repeated in Vayakha. Everything, no detail is missed out. And what's interesting is that in Parshas Truma, when they're discussed for the first time, the two Kruvim are called, as we said, Shnayim Kruvim. But in Parshas Vayakhel, the two Kruvim are called Shnei Kruvim. Why? What happened to them? The answer, says Rabbi Shua Heller, is the Chet HaEgel happened in the middle. According to the simple reading of the Psukim, they take the things as they came, the Egel happened in between the mitzvah of the Mishkan and the actual construction of the Mishkan, the Egel happened. As we know, the connection between the two Kruvim depends on the state of the Jewish people. As the Gemara says in Bava Basra and Daf Tzadik Tes, Bizman She'osim Ritzono Shel Makom, when the Jewish people are on level as they should be, Kruvim are facing each other. The Jewish people is not as they should be, cools off a little bit. They may be even facing away from each other or distancing from each other. And therefore, the Kruvim pre-Egel and post-Egel, the materials are the same, but the positioning is not the same anymore. Originally, there was much more of a cohesion between the two. Prior to the Egel, post-Har Sinai, that's called Shnayim Kruvim. But the distance that came, the cooling off that came to a degree with the Chet HaEgel, finds its expression in the Kruvim again. Next time you meet them, they're not Shnayim Kruvim anymore. Until further notice, they're Shnei Kruvim. One could almost say the goal of the Mishkan is to take the Shnei Kruvim and put them back into Shnayim Kruvim. How does this relate to testimony? We keep on moving between Shnayim Kruvim, Shnayim Edim. There is an interesting halacha. And here it is a basic halacha that divides capital cases from money cases. The Mishnah says in Maseches Makos, first perek, I think perek Daf Vav, in order to be accepted as two witnesses for a capital case, the two witnesses not only both need to witness that event, not only to have seen that event, they also need to have visual contact with each other. Just to make sure that in real time, each one is conscious of the other seeing, as well as seeing the event. If one saw, as the Mishnah describes it, if one saw from one window and one saw from the other window, but they didn't see each other, it's not accepted for capital cases. It's okay for money cases, but for that extra not for capital case, It's not accepted. That's called eidos miyuchedes, segregated testimony, where each one sees by themselves, but they don't see together as a team. Says Rabbi Shua Heller, all is revealed now. That is why there's two psukim that require two eidim. The first is with capital cases, the second is with monetary cases, but they're phrased differently because their halachos are different. With regards to the capital case, the two eidim are called shnayim eidim because they need to be connected to each other. They need to have visual contact with each other. That's called shnayim eidim. The second pasuk in Perek Yutes with regards to money, so they don't need to see each other. They just need to be two of them, but they don't need to be connected. Two that are not connected, what's that called? Shnei eidim. And I believe the question of their connection with each other and the way the Netziv spoke about it corroborate each other, and it's really quite fascinating to see how, again, how the Gedolim, how they look at the Psukim, and you see how the Halachas come out from these nuances, and everything is in place. There is a Mim there, there's not a Mim there, and so on and so forth. Now, I'd like to start in our remaining time, discuss again one of the major mitzvahs of Parsha Shoftim, although there are no minor ones, and that is the Parsha of Melech, of appointing a king. And let's take a look at Perek Yud Zayin, Pasuk Yud Dalet and Tesbav. Kisavol Aretz, Sheini. When you come to the land that Hashem is giving you, and inherit it and settle in it, and you will say, I will place upon me, over me, a king, as all the like all the other nations that are around me, says the Pasuk, Som tasim alecha melech, asheivchar Hashem elokecha bo. So you shall surely place a king over you, the one that Hashem will choose, Mikerev Achecha, and it goes on to give various stipulations as to who is qualified to be a king, as well as the mitzvahs that are unique to the king. Not too much of this, not too much of this. He has to write a second Sefer Torah, as we know those halachos. But there is a core machlokas in Chazal, that is to say, among the Tanoim, with regards to how to understand the Torah's attitude, so to speak, to having a king. And it's discussed in two places. They're largely similar. The Sifrei on our Pasuk, and also a Tosefta in Sanhedrin. And the Sifrei gives two opinions, commenting on the words, V'omar to asimo alai melech, and you shall say, I will place a king over me. Rabbi Nehoroi Omer, first to speak, Rabbi Nehoroi. He says, Hapasuk bignai Yisrael hu medaber. This pasuk is describing something which is not complimentary about the Jewish people. The idea that they are asking for a king is not ideal. And in fact, he backs it up from a pasuk in Shmuel, in Sefer Shmuel. Because the very first time the Jewish people asked Shmuel for a king, he was upset. And not only was he upset, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu said to him, don't worry, they don't have a problem with you. They have a problem with me. That's what the pasuk says in Shmuel Aleph Perek Ches, Ki lo oscha ma'asu, ki osi ma'asu memloch aleihem. They don't want me to be king over them. They're looking for some other king, or king in between, or whatever. So that's Rabbi Nehoroi. Now, Rabbi Yehuda comes in. Rabbi Yehuda. V'halo mitzvah min haTorah. No, it's a mitzvah from the Torah. Lish'ol lahem melech, to ask for a king. Shenemar, som tasim melech haMelech, Hashem yivchar, Hashem elokecha bo. Hashem chooses the king. It's all good. It's all positive. The Torah wants you to ask for a king. Now you may ask, so then why did Shmuel react so harshly? And why was that endorsed by HaKadosh Baruch Hu, his negative appraisal of them asking for a king? V'lama ne'en shubimei Shmuel? Why were they punished in the time of Shmuel? L'fi shekidimu al yodam. They asked too prematurely. We have to find out what that means. What does that mean? They asked prematurely. When's the right time? And they've been settled in the land for a good long while. This is in the time of Shmuel. This is 300 years into Yishuv Haaretz. Now, in terms of Parshanut, very important to realize, we shouldn't oversimplify and say something that is inaccurate. All agree there is a mitzvah called Melech. Appointing a king is a mitzvah. As the Pasuk says explicitly in Pasuk Tesvav, Som tasim alecha melech, you shall indeed place a king upon you. So what is the question? The question is there a mitzvah to ask for a king? As if to say, there are certain mitzvahs in the Torah where this should happen, and then the following should then resultantly happen. But there are other mitzvahs in the Torah where there's no reason for this to happen, but if it does, there's a mitzvah way to respond to it. And let us perhaps even give a neutral example, and maybe then a less than neutral example. The Torah says, if you buy a new house, there's a mitzvah to build a makeh. Ketivna, buy a chadash. But there's no mitzvah to buy a new house. But that situation will engender an obligation. Here, the critical question, no one is questioning what the first words of Pasuk Tesvav mean. Som tasim alecha melech. That means, if you speak Hebrew, that means you shall indeed place a king above you. That's a mitzvah. The question is, how are we to understand the words that come before that? Where it says, V'amarta asim alei melech. And you will say, I will place a king above me. Okay. So, as if to say, it's like this. There's two ways the Torah can give a mitzvah. One is in an imperative form, like kadesh, right? Kadesh li kol b'chor. That's an imperative form. It's unambiguous. But sometimes, in fact, many times, the Torah uses what's called loshon beinoni, a descriptive form, but it still refers to a mitzvah. What's an example? V'asu lehem tzitzis. That's descriptive, but it's a mitzvah. So how do you know when the Torah is describing something, when does it stop describing and begin prescribing? What's a good example of both? Benching. V'ochalta, or v'ochalta, v'savata, uve'rachta. Grammatically, those three words are exactly the same. But two of them are a description, and one of them is a command. V'ochalta, you will eat, v'savata, you will be satisfied. That's not a mitzvah. There's no mitzvah saseh to eat and be satisfied. I mean, it's a good thing to do. But v'rachta is no longer describing. That's already a mitzvah. So now the question is, these, you see the opening words, right? V'yishtav, v'yashabtaba, that's all describing. And here is the phrase caught in the middle. V'amarta, asimo alai melech, k'chol ha'goyim asher sevivo sai. That word, v'omarta. Well, in terms of our example, is that like v'chalta v'savata? Or is it like uve'rachta? Is that still describing? Meaning the Torah is not commenting on whether you should say this. If you do, the next pasuk is a response. Or is it no? Is this part of the mitzvah to petition for a king? And that's really the machlokas between Rabbi Yehuda and Rabbi Nehoroi. And it translates really into a machlokas. Again, it's not a new machlokas, but even Rishonim, so to speak, take sides regarding this machlokas. The Ramban is of the opinion that it is a mitzvah to ask for a king, very much like Rabbi Yehuda. The Abarbanel is of the second opinion. He feels that there is no mitzvah to ask for a king. And moreover, not only is there no mitzvah to ask for a king, the Abarbanel feels that it is incorrect to ask for a king. It's not neutral. It's negative. And that actually is the words of the Sifrei. Begnusa, begnai Yisrael, lakos of medaber. It's actually something negative. It doesn't just say reshus. It sounds like it's negative. And the words of the Tosefta, lo ne'emar ela neged tar umosam. Tar omes is contentiousness. It's not a positive thing. In fact, the closest analogy that the Abarbanel brings for this is the mitzvah of Eishes Yifas Torah, which is the next week's parsha. In war, if the soldier sees this girl and he likes her, and right, the choshak taba, and he desires her, so there's a mitzvah in terms of how to deal with it. But there's no mitzvah to desire her in the first place. that's not necessarily so desirable itself at all. The Gemara famously says about that, Lo dibra Torah eleka neged yitzahara. That's the yitzahara. The Torah says you have to know how to deal with it. And the Abarbanel says, asking for a king is the same thing, especially with those words like Kechol Agoyim Asher Sivivosai, which really doesn't sound very pro-Jewish itself. Interestingly, a parenthetical comment. It should be mentioned, but it should be mentioned in parentheses. And I only mention it because the Abarbanel himself mentions it. The Abarbanel had his own experiences with Malchus, and he talks about it. If he didn't talk about it, I think it would be a presumption to talk about it, because you can never know how much a person's comments reflect their experiences. That's a presumption to say that. But he himself mentions, as we know, he did not have much nachas, certainly not in the end, from Malchus. He was the treasurer for the king and queen of Aragon. And then he saw them expel the Jewish people. They, I believe, offered, that's the expulsion of the Jews from Spain, 1492. He only started writing his sforim after he was expelled. Which means, we don't like to say it, but for the Jewish people, it was better that he stopped being the treasurer. But certainly he had seen up close, at the very least, how monarchy can be corrupted. But once again, there's a long way between that before that translates into one's position on monarchy per se. But for whatever reason, he says explicitly he does not consider it to be a positive thing. But the Gemara seems to be really going like Rabbi Huda. The Gemara famously says in Sanhedrin that the Jewish people were commanded with three mitzvahs of crossing the Yarden. Appointing a king, wiping out Amalek, and building the Beis HaMikdash. Right? Shalosh mitzvahs nistavu Yisrael. And the way the Gemara talks about it really seems as if these are things that should happen. But clearly it has to happen in the right way. The question therefore is, if there is a mitzvah to ask for a king, as if to say, V'amarta is a mitzvah, so come back to the Jewish people in the time of Shmuel. Why were they criticized? What was wrong? Now, Rabbi Yehuda himself gives the reason they ask prematurely, but what does that mean? The Malbim explains that, and what's fascinating about this comment of the Malbim is he takes a concept with which we're familiar, but he reframes it for us. We know that the Jewish people underwent a major transition between, let's say, life in the wilderness and then life in Eretz Yisrael. Life in the wilderness, as we've discussed many times, it's all spiritual, it's all man from heaven, clouds of glory, the Mishkan, Moshe Rabbeinu, it's all like that. And then you cross into Eretz Yisrael, and it's much more natural. And that's a transition. But says Malbin, the transition didn't stop there, because the transition itself took time. And that was the period of the Shoftim. At that time, there is no king, because the Jewish people are yet leading a kind of an existence, even in Eretz Yisrael, which is much more spiritual in nature. And that's why when they need it, a miracle happens, Yericho. I mean, that's not normal, what happens with Yericho, those walls to come tumbling down, and so on and so forth with each of the Shoftim. And the final installment of that was Shmuel Hanavi. And the question is, when is the right time to ask for a king? The right time to ask for the king is when the Jewish people have naturalized. But if they naturalize too quickly, that means that it's going to be unhealthy and incorrect. The words, the introductory words in Pasuk Yud Dalet, V'rishtov yashavtem bo, you need to settle into the land. But you need to settle into land the right way. As surely as you cannot enter the land of Israel without the critical time, that formational time in the Midbar, you cannot enter into a time where monarchy is a beneficial thing until you've had enough time where your leaders are the prophets and the Shoftim. And Shmuel was the last of those. And the Jewish people were just in a little bit too much of a hurry to finish with the Shmuel way of doing things and already move into the king way of doing things. And Shmuel was upset about that. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, don't take it badly. It's a core problem. It's not about you. It's about me. So it's all about timing. That's really the insight into what Rabbi Yehuda says. I will share with you just in conclusion, though, a very interesting comment of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And many Rishonim talk about this, the Radak and the Ran and others. If there is a mitzvah to ask for a king, where did they go wrong in the way they asked for a king? And Rabbi Yisrael Salanter says, our pasuk says, "Va'amarta." Back again, pasuk Yudal. "Va'amarta asimo alai melech v'chol agoyim asher sivivosai." I will place upon me a king like all the nations that are around me. Okay. Now, if this is kosher, and according to Rebbe it's kosher, that means there has to be an aspect of "v'chol agoyim asher sivivosai" which is acceptable, as if to say, in order to lead the country in a way which is consonant with the how countries are led, at least in a temporal way. What happens when the Jewish people asked for a king? Very similar, but not the same. They said, they said to Shmuel, "Hine ata zakanta, you've become old. Your children are going in your way. Ata now, simalanu melech l'shofteinu kechol hagoyim." Now, of the differences between their request and the Torah's request, is that the says Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, the Torah says, the mitzvah is to say, "Asima alai melech." They said, "Sima lanu melech." What is the difference between except placing a king alai and placing a king li? What's aleinu and lanu? The difference is a whole world. Because the truth is that to ask for a king, there's a right way and a wrong way. Because once you've asked for it, you've got it. And when the king says, goes. And in its purest sense, the king is meant to represent HaKadosh Baruch Hu's authority. And he might always make the most popular decisions. But it's the Jewish people that appointed the king. They may be in the appointing stage. That's the last time they have a voice. And that's why it's such a delicate thing. There's only one kosher way to ask for a king. And that's the king which is alai, which is over me. Because if you ask for a king which is lanu, which is for us, so then that's no longer representatives from the people for the people, but that's leaders from the people being led by the people. Leaders cannot be led by the people. Because then that's just another, that's basically institutionalized hefkeros. And that, says Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, is where the problem lay. To say asimo alai melech, when you're ready, and you've got to say it because you've got to be ready. It's amazing. If there's a mitzvah to say it, it doesn't happen before you say it. Because if you're not ready for what Malchus really is, the whole thing could be corrupt. But to say Sima Lanu Melech, a leader cannot be always at the mercy of the people in that way. It brings to mind the famous Mishnah Pirkei Avos, where I think it's Rabbi Yossi ben Kisma. He said he was once walking and he met someone. He says, "Ritzon chashetador imanu b'kamenu, you want to come and live with us? And we'll give you gold and silver." B'chule, he says, "I'm only going to live in a place of Torah." So ask the Mefarshim, well, doesn't every place need a rabbi? I mean, if all rabbis only live in a place of Torah, there'll be no rabbis anywhere. And I add, that's not a good thing. So why is he saying this? I mean, it's a fair request, says the Maharal. You know what the problem is? Look how the question was asked. "Ritzon cheshetador imanu b'mkum, you can live with us. Become one of us, and I'll make you the rabbi." The rabbi can't be imanu. He can't be one of them in the sense. He needs to be an authority figure for them. He needs to be connected with them, sympathetic to them. He needs to care for them, but he can't be one of them because then he's at their mercy, and then the whole thing is a waste of time. So these are certain comments, again, as we move from Shoftim v'Shotrim, ironically, just to tie in the end of the parsha to the beginning, or the end of our shir to the beginning. The beginning is about the responsibility of the leaders towards their people to lead them correctly. But as we move into the parsha, there's a certain responsibility of the people towards their leaders to choose them correctly and to choose them for the right reasons. When that happens, if that balance is struck, the outcome is positive as the Torah intends. We'll leave it over there for this evening.